Blog Talk Radio.
On July 1st of this year, the interest rates on Stafford student loans, the same loans that many of you used to help pay for college, are set to double. And that means some hardworking students will be paying about $1,000 extra just to get their education. So I've called on Congress to prevent this from happening. What we said is simple. Now is not the time to make school more expensive for our young people.
Oh, yeah. You should listen to the president. Or as I like to call him, the Prezi of the United States. Things are heating up inside Congress's chambers behind all those closed doors. So the president made a few discreet calls across the aisle. He said, hey, let's get together on this one. Without an affordable Stafford loan, where can a student turn? The Pell Grant is a beautiful thing, but with college getting more expensive, is it enough by itself to satisfy all your collegiate needs? Oh, hell no. Oh, hell no. If Congress doesn't act, it's the student who play. The right and left should join on this like Kim and Kanye.
Now, there's some in Congress who disagree. They say keeping the interest rate low isn't the way to help our students. They say we should be doing everything we can to pay down the national debt. Well, so long as it doesn't include taxing billionaires. But their position is that students just have to make this rate increase work. Frankly, I don't buy it.
The Barackness monster ain't buying it. We all know our legislative body is in the House tossing and turning late into the night. But still, Republicans disagree and could even filibuster. But if they do, the president says they're gonna feel it, Buster.
The GOP is steady saying no, no, no. They should start something new to do like Tim Tebow.
The reason it's so important to keep down costs is so we keep college affordable.
And the president knows his stuff, y'all. That's why they call him the POTUS, which means person on top. What is it?
Jimmy, POTUS stands for President of the United States.
He's the POTUS with the most.
Let's keep the rates down on college loans.
Stop the loan you say may be your own. Yeah. Let's get it together and make our lives better. Cause the college degree is more than a few letters. If college don't rise, we'll have financial blues.
It's how we slow jam the news.
Oh, yeah.
Give it up for President Barack Obama. More with the president we got back. Come on back.
We have we're going to have Marsha Harvey co-host the show with me today.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And could you tell the listening audience your modus operandi? In other words, are you wanted by any agency of the federal government?
Not at this time.
Not this time? Okay,
I'm not.
All right. Well, I'm getting the twitches in every minute, so if your name appears, I'll give you a heads up so you can leave.
So I can get out in time, okay.
Yeah. So tell us, what are you doing in Raleigh?
Well, I have my own consulting business, and I'm elected as to the Wake County Soil and Water Conservation Commission here in Wake County.
Mm-hmm.
So, and enjoying it very much.
And what does the Soil and Water Commission do?
Well, we maintain relationships with basically monitoring the conservation in Wake County. Soil, and farming. And in Wake County, you know, of course, we have an abundance of horse farms. I think it last count about 210 horse farms in Wake County. And they are the biggest polluters in Wake County of our streams and tributaries that lead into our water system. So we have to monitor that very closely.
Now, wait a minute. The horses are polluting the streams?
Yes, sir. Because usually what happens is that horse farmers usually have horse waste, and they store it. And when it rains, the water, rainwater, carries it all everywhere through those underground streams. And it usually ends up someplace like the Neuse River or some parts of Falls Lakes or some parts of other tributaries that we have in the county and beyond. Some are in the Pamlico River Basin. That's far away in the Pamlico River Basin.
But wait a minute. So you mean, how are they storing this? Are they just laying it out in the field? They don't put it inside boxes or something?
Yes. Yes.
So, and what are they storing it for? For
a
rainy
day? You sell it. You sell it. You grow things with it. It's used as fertilizer.
Okay. Well, so then when it goes into the stream, it's not fertilizing anything.
No, it's not. No, it's not. It's becoming a problem at that point. Because these tributaries are feed into our main water sources throughout the county. You can do fertilizer in Wake County and it ends up in the Neuse River or the Trent River or the Pamlico River or any of the other rivers going downstream from us. So that's why when you water your lawn in Charlotte,
right,
never do it when it's raining because it goes everywhere.
Well, I mean, why would you water a lawn? I got a good-looking lawn now, I want to tell you that. Now, hey, that must be all that dung in the water,
no,
though, right?
No. Tributaries, they are underground streams that are all over every place.
Right.
And these sediments get into that, and so they then take a path, and they take some years. But they get to our main water sources, which is usually going out to our coast.
Okay.
We've had several fish kills in the Neuse River. Well, it's because of the fact that the Neuse River is one of the most polluted rivers in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So to clean that up, you'd have less fish kills. But we still have some smaller towns dumping human waste into the Neuse River.
Right.
Problem. Everybody doesn't have a waste treatment plant in North Carolina.
Well, I see that you have two very important guests sitting next to you. Can you introduce, while I click on their mic, introduce your two guests?
Yes. I have the Honorable Brad Thompson, who is president of BTA and Associates here in Raleigh. And I have next to him is the Honorable Fred Yates. What's the name of your metropolitan?
Finfall. I'm here. I'm here. How you doing? Well, we've gotten off to a real fast and good start, I believe. Thursday we talked about what small towns can do to increase their competitiveness using whatever assets they have, including things like tourism and other things that you may not imagine that would attract people to your town. That was a workshop that was attended by a number of towns, and that was followed up by last evening. We had a tremendous reception featuring Joe Austin, the Paul Malik singer of the Temptations, and a couple of acts. And that was very enjoyable. This morning we started off with our opening session where we really recommitted ourselves to the things that we had previously chosen to work on, like things like economic empowerment, education, criminal justice, those types of things. And we have we read our strongly developed commitment statements.
Mm-hmm.
And before we go into lunch, and lunch was hosted by Anita Khan, who's an economist. But in the meantime, we've had Dan Wu, who's had, and it's been chock full of activity and personality. And I must say, it's been both enjoyable and enlightening for the people who participated.
Now, how did you and Miss
Lee and who get together?
Yes.
Before, because at one time was the PAC chairman of the NAACP. And I used to go to the PAC meetings quite a bit. but I knew him pretty much as NAACP chair. But about 6-7 years ago, we started having meetings on the things that we could do together to help African-American people. And Mary H. and I just kind of hit it off, and we've been good pals ever since. He's in Windfall, I'm in Raleigh, but he seems to be able to come to Windfall faster than I can get to he just seems to come to Raleigh faster than I can get to Windfall. I think he just...
Can you tell us a little
bit? Well, I'm native of West Virginia, but born in North Carolina by way of West Virginia. Been here about 40-50 years, so I like the water, so I'm going to stay.
Like the water.
I met Brad some years ago, and he proposed some ideas, and I agreed with him 100%. And we just hit it off, and we've been able to do this summit every year for the past 7 years, and each year it gets better and better.
So how many years was
it? This is the seventh year that we've
Yeah, this is the seventh year. Well, this is my fifth year, and it's really become a major thing in Raleigh, and it's always been so it's almost like I'm having a birthday party.
Yeah, one of the things that I really enjoyed, other than the entertainment last evening and the workshops and some of the group, but one of the things you highlighted this morning was in a workshop dealing with economic development and entrepreneurship, and we had some young people. I'm sitting around 30 years old, that was participating in the discussion. One of them is a mayor, and the other one is an attorney, and they lit up the room. So we were catching fire, and they didn't know it was this good, so they made a comment that they would be back next year.
More people, we have to get involved. More people than
that. Yeah, it's... I think the word will start spreading now because they say when they go back to their areas, they're going to let people know that this is where to be at this particular time of year. My good friend, Brother Rogers, is here. But we're really making strides, and we're dealing with issues. We're not dealing with people. We're dealing with issues that we have people in the total community. Not only here in Raleigh, but across the state of North Carolina.
The thing I want to know is the alliance for black elected officials needs to bring to the table so they can solve.
Well, it's numerous things, with most of all the partnerships being built with the North Carolina Legislative Caucus and the County Commission, School Board, black mayors. We're getting together and dealing with issues, not people, issues. And that's where the major piece is. The leadership caucus plays a major role as well. So once we leave here, we will have a white paper, blue paper, whatever you want to call it. We will have a plan of action for the next year. And that plan of action will be put into place, and we will advocate for it. And maybe I don't know what it's going to be this year, but possibly you got candidates running for the governor of the state. We would like to know their what they're going to do for it if they get elected governor of the state. You got people running for different offices. Let them come and tell us what they're going to do. Not wait till they get an office
or promise
the world and deliver nothing.
Right, right. And speaking to Marshall, in the last 7 years, the way the Alliance has conducted these events.
Well, I've seen the groups getting larger and larger, and more people are becoming involved, more elected.
How has the elected officials taken to this?
Well, you see more and more each year.
The black elected officials. Matter of fact, all the elected. I saw Bob Eckert here last night. Matter of fact, I think he was the only one running for office was here last night. Is that correct?
No. There were Senate governor candidates. Mansfield was here.
Oh, that's right. Mansfield was here, right?
Some local folks in our district. Rosa Hill was here. I believe Linda was here also. But there were quite a few that were
right. I know quite a number by Linda Coleman. I think Bob Rutgers is going to try to get back, and Mansfield is going to be here, and so there's going to be quite a few people here. But since you're here, I mean, do we get anybody else? You and Mayor Yates here, I mean, do we need anybody else?
I think the more the merrier.
Well, as you guys, so we can say goodbye to Mayor Yates. Put him back on the phone this minute.
All right, hold on.
Yes, sir. Mayor, I just want to thank you for giving all the time that you and Brad put into putting this occasion together for the seventh straight year. And I can say for a fact, every year I have come, it has grown by leaps and bounds. And we need to, I'm going to make it a point to have it tied to my my site and the Facebook page to make sure this gets out to everybody, to make sure that everybody has a chance to come here and participate, because it was really smoking last night. I think you must have hung up, did you?
Our nose is going to come out of this. We're going to look at the pre-K situation. You know, they build prisons out there, third grade. So we want to get on top of it and find out why the state wants to cut out pre-K. And the counties is not going to be able to afford to pay for it. And that's one of the main issues. But other than that, we thank you for being part of this summit as well.
Well, you know, the thing is they want to stop building pre-K so they can build after-school prisons.
Right. And we're gonna throw a rock at that. We ain't gonna let that run.
Well, I want to thank you once again for participating and everything you've done so far in these many years. And everybody should be very grateful. But we're gonna make sure that we get the word out across the state even more than what it is now, that people can come in and come to this this fabulous affair. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I just wanted to read one thing here. This is unbelievable. It says, Republicans saying that we can no longer blame President Bush for the country's problems because too much time has passed is like saying we can't blame Osama bin Laden with the attack on 9/11. I mean, it don't work. We cannot any longer blame this president for things that have occurred in the previous 8 years that's going to take another 8 years to cure. What do you think about that, Mr. Marshall?
Well, you can say whatever you want to say about the 8 years that Bush was in the White House. Most of the troubles we have now can easily be traced back to his administration. When President Obama came into office, he came into office under a cloud, and he tried.
But it wasn't his cloud.
No, it wasn't his cloud. No, it was not his cloud. It was a cloud that had been created by the Bush administration, the programs, the tax breaks, and all of the things that had been laid out. They were a part of the Bush administration, and people really wanted them to continue to work. But there was just a problem with all of that. And the president inherited an economy that was really in almost in the toilets at the time. And some of the things if he had not done some of the things, in this particular with the auto industry, people don't realize that the auto industry affects all parts of our lives here in America. And if it had gone under, we would have really been in trouble. Then our bank.
And just don't drive a car. That doesn't mean it doesn't.
No. You got so many other facets that belong to that industry.
You're absolutely correct. And they keep saying, well, what has he done for us? Well, you know, these are some of the things that the President of the United States has accomplished in 3 years and 5 months. The Affordable Care Act, he ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He stopped defending DOMA. The Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act for Women, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He ended the war in Iraq. He got Osama bin Laden. He created the structure for getting to Gaddafi. and he also saved the American auto industry. Now, if George Bush even dreamt about doing that many things in his 8 years, it would even have been a blessing. But when you have no vision and all you think about is what happened today, nothing can be accomplished. Nothing. And then we have now, you were going to say something?
I was going to say that you're absolutely right, Michael, that, you know, and if we don't turn this thing around, it's going to get worse.
Well, we were talking last night. We had, I don't know what sort of hours in the morning it was last night, but we had a great conversation with
Moses Matthews.
And it was almost like solving the UN's problems. I mean, we were on every single subject, left and right. And a lot of it is so basic. A lot of it is so basic. But we have a culture of trying to bring down this president that is almost becoming just in the nature of everybody running for office now. In the regressive party.
Well, Michael, you know that the very night that the president was inaugurated was the night that the Republicans made their plan that no matter what this man does, no matter how successful he can be, we're not going to work with it. So that was the plan of action for the and it worked through the 2010 election. Most of those so-called Tea Party people that went to D.C. They were part of the plan. But there are some Republicans who may want to work with the president, but they are afraid of retaliation from the majority of Republicans, and particularly the Tea Party Republicans. So you can't get the full effect of the moderate Republicans that would be willing to go across the aisle and work with the Democrats on some things. We have Democrats that do that, go across the aisle and work with Republicans. But it has not been vice versa yet. So,
as a matter of fact, we've had too many Democrats to want to go across the aisle.
We've had too many to go across the aisle. But we didn't sit down the night that the president was inaugurated and make plans to disrupt the country.
Right.
You know, Malcolm X had talked about any means necessary. Well, I think the Republicans took that night and said, any means necessary to destroy President Obama and to have him be a one-term president, anything. And that means allowing this country to go under. We've had too many crises and the debt ceiling and all of that stuff. That need not happen. You know, you'd lose your credit rating. You know, you'd lose your credit rating. And it's just been a sham. We've never had that kind of politics in this country, in the history of this country.
That is absolutely true. We got another caller online. Who is this?
Hey, Mike. Nope. Rob Hillman.
Yes.
Hey, how are you?
Doing very well. Rob, this is Robert Hillman, who's running for County Commissioner in Mecklenburg County. And how is everything in Mecklenburg County today?
It's sunny.
Skies?
Skies are clear.
And are you out at the polls?
I'm actually out in the neighborhood. I went to a community meeting and got to talk to some of the folks that at a temple.
Good. While everybody's listening, this is the first time hearing from you, tell us what a short one or two bullet points or so of why you want to be county commissioner in Mecklenburg County.
Sure. I mean, in terms of why I want to be or what motivated me to serve was one, there were a couple of specific incidents that come to mind. And one was where I was at the Tuesday morning breakfast forum, and they were talking about students not having books in school and sharing books. And so that kind of incensed me. I just didn't understand, having gone to public school and ultimately having gone to MIT to get an engineering degree and to NYU to get an MBA in international business and finance, how we were expecting our children to be competitive when they did not have books to read. And so that was somewhat of a catalyst. Part of that came from the other catalyst was back in 2010 when I was knocking doors. I knocked on one particular door where the man was incensed about the fact that schools in his neighborhood had been disproportionately closed relative to others. And so it is sort of that area that has kind of sparked my interest in helping. And I decided that I could no longer sit on the sideline and that I had to get involved. And I encourage as many folks as possible to get involved in the political process to make a difference, so that it, because that is how we're going to make change that our president has asked us to do. Briefly, you know, I'm running for county commissioner on there are three tenets to my platform. One is job creation, infrastructure development, and the third is educational/vocational training. And I think if we can get these three things right, we can grow our economy, and if we can grow our economy, we can afford some of the vital social services that many of our citizens desperately need. And I think from a qualification standpoint, the reason I'm qualified for the job is I'm a numbers guy, and the job is essentially a budgeting job. And so I've got a chartered financial analyst. I've worked on Wall Street for 20 or so years analyzing budgets, and it's these technical skills that I bring to the table. More importantly than the technical skills, however, I think is the heart that I bring to it from over a lifetime of experience as a leader in the community. And so it's the combination of these two things that I think will make me a great county commissioner at large in Mecklenburg County.
Okay, now what? I'm back when I got disconnected off the blog. I had to go back in. What is you think the situation on the county commission now that you could change with your election to the county commission?
I think temperament is certainly one thing that I could change. I think also to talk a little bit more about that, I think one of the important things that we must as human beings always realize is we begin in one mouth and two ears. And it's important that we listen to one another and that we understand where people are coming from so that we can figure out where there's common ground for things that our citizens need us to do. Some of the acrimony, some of the bickering that we've seen on the county commission are really a function of very basic things that we teach our children, which is to respect one another. So if people respected one another, I think we could get a lot more done. I've got a very good temperament. I've worked with people. I'm very good at listening, negotiating, finding the common ground, and then putting together an action plan to move down the road to execute it.
Okay, so you believe realistically that your financial abilities that you bring to the table are something that is sorely needed on the county commission?
Oh, absolutely. I think the conversations on the county commission, if you listen to them, they're tremendously complex. A lot of issues come up. One of the issues comes up over, the debt rating, for instance. And I have experience working with the rating agencies and understanding their processes. And so as a county commissioner, I'm very sensitive to the needs to keep and maintain the credit rating. Being able to analyze budgets is a lot of the other folks who come to the table, I think, possess a lot of the same things as it relates to compassion and interest in serving mankind and womankind. Mm-hmm. But I think what I bring that's different and that's unique is that I've got a financial guy. I've worked on Wall Street. I analyze companies, for my own personal investments. I work with clients to analyze their investments as well.
Okay, but see, the thing that I understand, and I'm sure that would be a great great compliment to the commission. But you can't get blood from a stone, and if we have these same knuckleheads like Virginia Fox, well, she's not up in Raleigh, but these other like Tillis and all these people that are cutting the budget of every county in the state so they can cripple it, so it was a bad on Obama's watch. You can't work with anything if you're not getting any money. How do you help if you don't have the funds coming in from out?
Well, I think you also have to look at efficiency, and you have to try to, and now, granted, I'm sure that the current county commission has done a job at looking at efficiencies, trying to find and trying to squeeze every last dollar out of
that's a nice word, efficiency, but speaking English, that people understand. Because efficiency to me means I got to cut something.
You got to cut something. You can't. You only got $100. You can only spend $100. You got to figure out what's the best expenditure for the $100 possible.
Right.
And
how
that
is that done? How is that done?
Say again. How is that?
How is that accomplished? What do you weigh? How do you weigh it and say, you know what? We don't need that because we need to have this. Because
in your household,
you're going to rub somebody
like,
the wrong way.
You're always going to rub somebody the wrong way.
That's right.
The job is not to be everybody's friend. The job is to make sure that we utilize the money that we receive from the taxpayers to the highest and best use, and that we make sure that we are, you know, prudent and watchful servants of the people as it relates to how their money is spent. And so, like in your household, when you say, well, you know, am I eating steak today or am I eating tuna casserole? Well, if you don't have any money,
wait a minute. You heard what Sean Hannity said 2 days ago. He says, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. People don't have to eat steak every day. They can go get a cheaper cut of meat and eat some beans. Beans is good fiber.
Well, I mean, notwithstanding the fact that I'm not a huge Sean Hannity fan, my grandmother grew up in as many people have grandmothers, grew up in the Great Depression. And, you know, what they did to survive, you know, as you know, related from her to me, was they cut back. They did whatever they could to survive, to make it through to better times. And I think, you know, we have to figure out, you know, how to do that. But we have to balance it in a compassionate way as opposed to sort of in a brutal Darwinian way where we say, well, you know, those people, you know, they are poor, they deserve to be poor, and so, you know, they deserve whatever they get or they deserve whatever they don't get. We have to sort of look at the budget from the perspective of what can we sensibly pare back on while we await for better times. And, you know, better times will come. Better times are ahead of us.
And I understand. You're absolutely correct. The problem is convincing the individual, you don't need to eat steak tonight, but don't worry, I'm going to eat mine.
Well, no, that can't be the case. That's the premise that Sean Hannity works under, right? Since I have the money, I can eat steak. No, I think the premise has to be that we have a shared responsibility in terms of moving our society forward. There are certain things, education for children, priority. We've got to have those priorities because if we don't prioritize that, there is no future, right? So if we don't care back on – go ahead.
Bob, let me cut in and ask you a question here. How do you see creating jobs? What would you do to create jobs in Mecklenburg?
There are kind of three things that I focus on. I mean, the job situation, in my opinion, is something that needs to be focused of the focus of all elected officials, federal, state, county, and city officials, in the sense that if our people are sitting on the sidelines, they're losing their skills, and if they lose their skills, they lose their future. But a couple things I would be focused on is training. We need to get people, you know, training. I would also focus on transportation. There are jobs that people can't get to in Mecklenburg County because they are in, you know, a different part of the county where it's very expensive for the people to rent, so they need to live someplace where it's cheap. But the bus schedule to that area is not the best, not the most frequent. The third would be promotion. We need to promote our region and our county as one of the best places to do business, and we have to set up our services, things like the permitting process, to reflect the fact that we are interested in attracting business here and we're going to be business friendly. So the things I would do is, again, tax incentives, regulatory reform, and promotion.
Oh, well, now, if the county commissioners are like the ones we have in here in Wake County, that can be very difficult from the board, from the commission itself, to implement programs because of what you talked about earlier was respecting each other and communicating. How are you going to deal with that?
Well, fortunately, for good or for bad, and this is one of the reasons why Charlotte's a great place in my opinion when I first moved down here, is that it's a very accessible town. The folks on the city council, very accessible. The folks on the school board, to some degree, accessible. Some of the other county commissioners, also accessible. And so, I've been fortunate, lucky, however, whatever you want to have developed relationships with people across the board, at the state level, at the county level, and at the city level. And I believe the idea is that once you've established relationships with people, once you respect them, and they respect you, you can collaborate, and you can get things done.
Well, I just want to thank you for calling in, Robert, and good luck today. And next week, what is it, the 30th, all the regional libraries open up, correct?
The regional libraries open on the 30th, and I'm encouraging all folks that to vote early and to vote for Robert Hillman. And if you want to find out more information about me, go to my website, voteforhillman.com. And also having a fundraiser at 300 East Restaurant on Monday, starting at 4:30. And so it'll be a great opportunity for you to come out and meet me and ask me questions directly and make a little donation.
Robert, I'd like to wish you luck. And I think the state could use more people who's willing to think like you.
Well, I appreciate that comment, and thank you very much for the time, Michael, and for all the voters out there. Again, my name is Robert L. Hillman, and I'm asking for your vote. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. And who's this on the line?
Hello, Michael. This is Lionel Vaughn, former chair of North Carolina Black Leadership Caucus and two-time mayor pro tem of the city of Dunn. And I'm just delighted to have this opportunity today to encourage people across this state to get out and vote on May 8th. Think of this as the practice run for November. We certainly have a lot of interest, and we've got to express those interests to those people who are running for office, statewide office, or a national office, and we need to be present May 8th and not just simply go out in November and vote for other people's choice.
Where are you out of, Cornell?
I live in Harnett County, city of Dunn.
Harnett County, yes, that's... Let's see, who is down there? She's the head of the AAC down there.
I'm sorry, did you hear that one?
She was the head of the AAC down there. She's the head of the AAC in Harnett County. Who is that?
Barbara McCoy.
That's right, Barbara McCoy. Yeah, so when you see Barbara, matter of fact, I heard from Barbara about 2 weeks ago. She wanted me to see who I was voting for and if I would vote for Etheridge. So I told her, well, she needs to call into the show, but we have you. We don't need Barbara.
Oh, well, Barbara's doing a good job around the county, and she's trying to get people motivated to go out,
right,
early vote, and vote May 8th. And we have a specific interest in this race. We think we've got one of our homeboys who is uniquely qualified to be governor of North Carolina.
Well, I was speaking to you last night, and you were giving me a little bit of background on Senator Etheridge. Can you tell the audience a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. And I'd like to start off this way by saying my name is Cornell Robinson, and I'm supporting Bob Etheridge for governor because he's uniquely prepared, having served at all levels of government. In the early 70s, Bob was chairman of our county commissioners, and even though our citizens voted against consolidated schools 3 times, Bob built the schools. Bob moved on to the North Carolina General Assembly as a member of the House, ended up on the Appropriations Committee, For the older people, that was the time when we had the Gang of Eight. Bob actually introduced the basic education plan for North Carolina and made sure that historically black colleges and universities were finally given adequate funding by the North Carolina General Assembly. Then Bob moved to Congress, where he also rose to the Ways and Means Committee. Bob Edwards helped to bring more than $500 million to North Carolina for the education system. In addition to that, he has been very instrumental in building a hospital in our central part of our county at a time when there were no funds. And Bob continued to support historically black colleges and universities. I understand when the mothership, Shaw University, ran into trouble a few years ago.
Could you explain to some of the people when you say the mothership? A lot of people might not know from around the country.
I'm sorry?
Well, explain to us when you say the mothership. A lot of people from around the country and the world might not know what that means.
That's Shaw University, second oldest historically black college in the United States, I believe. Shaw had.
It was the first university. It was created in 1865, the year that slavery was
freed
and the Civil War.
And who was it created by?
Built by the Shaw family, Robert Shaw, Robert Shaw. That's who it was named for.
When you say the mothership, that means it is the first one, huh?
Yes, the first
one. I think people need to remember that A&T actually started on Shaw's campus. NCCU, you know, came out of the Shaw family. It has definitely been an important institution for those of us here in North Carolina. And the other thing I say about my candidate for governor is that many people are forgetting that he has integrity and leadership. When we came up on the issue of health care reform, he could have done like a lot of other people in Congress, but he stood with our president because it was the right issue.
Yeah, absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. How does Bob think about the health care? I know he's very much involved with education, but how does he feel about health care?
I think that vote with the president on reform indicates a very strong commitment to making sure that health care, you know, in America does not depend on a person's net worth.
And, you know, one of the things that we had is that we had a major concern with some of these Blue Dog Democrats that did not stand with the president. And that's why it took us so long, and that's why we had to cut so much and didn't get to a single fair.
I really think that, you know, we spent too much time celebrating the election of the president. We stayed home. In 2010, we allowed too much opposition to get elected, and we really got a challenge this time, and that's why I think Bob Edwards would be a great candidate for governor, and I think the president would enjoy working with Bob from that position.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show today, and last night when you left, we were there for another 3 hours.
It was a great evening. I'm so glad to be here at the Black Summit. There's a lot of information here, and it's always great to see people who are out doing things and in the network.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to thank you, and we need to have you running for office shortly.
Well, we'll certainly talk about that, and if I can get you and a few other friends to finance the campaign, I'm ready.
Oh, you can't do it with box tops and soda caps anymore?
No.
Okay. I want to thank you, Cornell. It's been a pleasure, and we'll be seeing each other later.
All right, and thank you so much for taking this call.
Thank you. That is Cornell Robinson, and let me Philadelphia. Well, Mr. Marshall, we were talking about last night's festivities up in Mr. Matthew's room.
Yes.
We talked about a lot of good stuff last.
We did, Michael. I think if you could draw a conclusion that we could solve the world's problem, we would have done it last night.
I did not agree with Mr. Matthew, but it wasn't anything where we had a, you know, with no fisticuffs.
No, it was.
Even though you were there.
Yeah, even though I was there, yeah.
That's right.
But for most of the conversation, I was always right, so there was no need for that. So, I'm always right.
I checked with your friend down in Lumberton last night, and he didn't think that you were right on anything.
Well, that's his opinion. You know, that's one man's opinion, okay?
Well, yeah, but what
one
a man.
One man's opinion.
What a man, though. You see, that's the thing. I wanted to wait and get Mr. The president of the Black Leadership Caucus on here. I know he's in the room there. So are they breaking up in there now?
Who, Roger?
Out, we'll grab, we'll get Walter on here.
Walter.
Walter, he's in there somewhere.
Listen, Walter Holly, right now.
Marshall, tell us now, what is all, here he comes to the mic right now.
There he is.
And,
here comes Roger.
Walter, if you come over here, I'll give you this phone. Walter, come over here. Hold on, as soon as it comes up. Okay, you go over there. Yeah, don't turn it off now. You're going to talk to me. You're going to over here. Walter, we're waiting here. Okay, well, we're just waiting for you to come out. Okay, yeah, you're on there. You can just go right over there. Okay, Walter, can I hear you? I can't hear you. I don't know.
Hello.
Okay, introduce yourself. You're not there. What'd you do? Every time you get near a phone, it's quiet. You hung up. I can't hear you.
Okay, Mike, what about now?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Fine. I hear you fine now. I can hear you. Hello. Now I got you, Walter. Okay, Walter.
Are you there?
This is Walter Rogers, who is the state chair of the Black Caucus in the state of North Carolina. And we're here in Raleigh at the Sheridan Hotel downtown. And Walter, tell us a little bit about the Black Leadership Caucus and about yourself.
Michael, thank you so much for the opportunity. The North Carolina Black Leadership Caucus was established in 1976. Its purpose was to help protect and to look out for the interests of low-wealth people and people of color. We also have a political action committee that we have blown life back in the last couple of years, and it is doing great, as everyone knows. North Carolina consists of 13 congressional districts. I personally live in the 8th, and anybody that is within riding distance, you are invited to the 8th congressional district.
And now, is that the newly revised 8th, or is that the real 8th now?
No, this is the original 8th.
But are you still in the 8th because of...
I'm still in the 8th. As I was saying, I'm inviting everybody to the 8th Congressional District Black Leadership Caucus Annual Banquet. It is coming up on May 5th. It's going to be at the Waddell Center up in the big county seat of Stanley County of Albemarle. So if you know where Albemarle is,
I'm going to be the MC for this event.
Yes, you are, and I think you're very fortunate. So I'll allow you to help me invite everybody.
Well, as long as I get something to eat. Am I going to be able to eat? Or?
Yes, we will allow you to eat. We will allow you to eat. And that is also the last day to early vote, too. I think it's about 12 or 1 o'clock that day. We ask everybody not to wait. We just ask them to vote early and don't wait until Saturday.
Absolutely
so
correct.
That is so important. You know, the only rights you have is the ones you can afford to protect. But when it comes to voting, you got to vote. You got to make sure that you protect that vote, because people do not want you to have it. They say, if it's important, somebody wants to take it from you.
Right. Well, who is the who's the guest speaker?
The guest speaker is going to be Eric Mansfield. Eric Mansfield is a state senator. As a matter of fact, he accepted that invitation
And a lot of information was distributed before we learned that he's a candidate for our lieutenant governor.
So he accepted this before he even knew he was going to be lieutenant governor for it.
Yeah, long before then. But we're excited. He's a fire and brimstone speaker.
Am I listening or talking? You're doing both.
Okay. He is a fire and brimstone speaker, and, you know, I have not sit under a speech that he's done yet. By the time he was through, I wasn't ready to go out and challenge everybody for what needs to be done right then.
Right.
He's a great fella, and he's a great product right now of Cumberland County, where he serves as a surgeon, as a minister, and a bunch of other things. But he's a good person, good person.
Well, we are, Marshall, you have anything to ask us? Your neighbor there?
Well, we try. We try.
Now, for some reason, I had lost you, Marshall. Well, I didn't hear that question. What was it?
Control. I just know.
I hear you now. You fine?
I hear you too.
There is a there is a lot of speculation that this we have a lot of I guess big pushes running for lieutenant governorship. We have Linda Coleman and Senator Mansfield, and we have who's the other one running? Oh, those are the only two.
Those are the only two, right? Yeah. But Michael, let me just say that either way, this year, this election, I think that we'll make history again. We made history with my classmate Ralph Campbell when he became the first African American to be elected statewide. Secondly, that this year we will have an African American lieutenant governor. I will say that, and I will live by my words that we will have an African American in the state of North Carolina. Howard Lee ran some time ago, but the thing that got him was that African Americans and folks don't tend to go back to vote on a second time when a person has a runoff. That hurts.
Right.
Howard Lee should have been the first African American to win a statewide election, but it didn't happen. Because
failure
of people to go back on to vote in the runoff. So, but this time,
what can we do about that? What can we get our people more involved?
Well, I think more education, and I think more education that we give our folks of the whole process. When there's a runoff, you don't need to stay home. Well, a lot of our people will say, "Well, I voted before." Well, that vote was null and void because of the runoff. Okay, so you need to go back. And a lot of our folks don't understand the process of going back to vote on a second time. So we need to continue our educational process to get these folks prepared in the event that there is a runoff. But in this case, I don't believe there will be. I think we'll have a clear winner on the 8th.
See, speaking about that... our people and how their voting thinking is, Walter, how do we get our people to participate more? How can we get them to understand the process more?
Michael, the answer is in information and motivation. Sometimes people don't understand the importance and what's really at stake. And like Marcia says, this year we've got a lot at stake. And when it comes to the general in November, it will be a history-making day for Black America. So if you do not get in there and do your job, and I mean everybody,
right?
Number one, you will regret today that you didn't. Number two,
when the day comes that everybody should be celebrating, we want nobody sitting around pointing fingers and complaining. Because you have the opportunity, you know what the stakes are, and there is no reason to sit on the fence.
Right. Right. Well, you see, but what you just said about there's no reason to sit on the bench when someone says to you, well, I already voted once, and you say, well, there was a runoff, so now you have to come back and vote again. Your vote was null and void. When there's a lot of elderly people who don't understand null and void, they don't understand.
Michael, that's where you go back to the term education. You have to educate people, and you have to help them to understand the significance, Michael, of not going the second time. And you're absolutely right. We suffer from that many a time.
There is too much at stake, especially now where they want to get rid of the first African-American president and labeling him with everything that's happened except the Ice Age. I mean, there has to be a way for us to get the information out. They were just looking at a statistic two days ago that said young people 18 to 25 voted 72% for Obama in 2008, and now the enthusiasm is down to 42%. So,
I don't buy that. If you saw this past week, every word that Barack Obama went as president of the United States, the college kids mobbed him. They loved him. They know that irregardless of the attitude of those people opposing him, some of them prove their only promise to the people is, I just want to get rid of him. I don't want this black man to be president for 2 terms. That's their only concern. And that's unfortunate, Michael. That's unfortunate that in 2012, people still cannot get past power. And for those people, the only thing we can do is pray for them, pat them on the back, and tell them to get behind them.
You know, Michael, W.E.B. Okay. Du Bois said in the 20s, he said the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the 21st century. And it's true. And it's race. It's all about race.
Right.
And our media is owned by folks who are usually on the other side of the table. And they set seeds or plant seeds out here. Because if you read the NNO on Tuesday morning, it says that the president was here, but the enthusiasm is dying among college students. Well, there were 9,000
right.
students showed up over there. To me,
right,
I think
right.
the enthusiasm is still there. We had kids asking us. I gave my tickets to people. I didn't go because of the fact that there were some young folks who wanted to go. But the enthusiasm
right, right.
is there. But the media would have you believe, that the students are losing faith in the president. I don't think
right.
so.
Right.
You can come down
right.
to BTA in the evening and you see young people out there making the phone calls. They work
right.
every night mostly at BTA and they're making phone calls. There's a different set of students each and every night that comes there to work. Now, to me that shows that there's not a lack of enthusiasm in reference to the president at this point. And I think it's going to grow the once we get out of the primary, all the primaries are over, and you get down to the real election. But our problem here in North Carolina is that the president, we got to help the president to win. Two, we got to clear the House in North Carolina. Because if we don't, we are going to take a tremendous hit here in North Carolina. Go back to the days of the 60s when I was in college. The old laws, the old kind of attitudes can come right back. You know, these guys are full of trickery. Their call sessions, they meet at 12 o'clock at night. You know, you may have gone, the representative may have gone home by then, and he may live in Rutherford County or someplace else. He can't turn around and come back to do a session that night. So all of these things, we gotta be aware of this election. It's a very important election for the next 10 years. And the way they drew some of these lines, the way they drew some of the voting lines is ridiculous. I mean, for instance, take myself, for instance. The guy who's across my back fence is in another district. We're in two different districts. He's in 16 and I'm in 4. I mean, that's ridiculous. And we live in the same neighborhood. Those are the kind of things that this group down on Jones Street done.
But you're absolutely correct. Go ahead. Go ahead. What are you saying? Yeah, the thing that I want everybody to understand, and I think I said this last night, you know, having Barack Obama as president of the United States is so important on many levels. But the president does not pass laws. And if we do not get back the state houses and the U.S. and Senate, we might as well not have Barack Obama as president.
That's absolutely true.
There's got to be nothing
we have to do that,
that he
Mike.
Can do about anything. Yeah.
You know, people can't sit home during this election.
People can't
say that Walter Rogers is going to do everything for them because everybody needs
that.
To be involved.
I can every night. I'll hope that Walter Rogers does something for me.
You want to do something for
me? Yeah,
Walter Rogers does do something for you. He helps to make sure that you can sleep comfortably without somebody coming in your window.
That's right.
And Marshall is absolutely right in that people have got to realize and understand not only the significance of the office of the president, but, you know, all politics are local.
Right.
When it comes to your North Carolina legislature, the only thing people have to do is look at what has either been done or attempted to know that it would not be in their best interest to have to live with that two more years, because everything that was attempted and failed will be there in 2 years from now.
Right.
You know, we got to put our shoulders to the wheel. We got to motivate and encourage, inform. Right, Mark?
Right. Michael, you read a statement a couple of minutes ago about that the president Bush could not be blamed for any of the things that are going on now because now the president has been in office long enough to have eradicated some of those problems.
That's what
the Republicans want you to believe.
Of course.
The president has not done all the things that have happened now are on his watch. Well,
absolutely.
He cleaned up a mess. To clean up a mess. And it's going to take years to clean this mess up. It's going to take years. It won't be done.
Well, what he did with his first few years, Marshall, was clean up the Bush mess.
Clean up the Bush.
And I mean, you were right at the brink of a collapse, governmental collapse. The millions, billions of dollars that he gave to the banks without any obligations or resource for getting it back, all of that stuff goes into it.
Yeah.
But what is even more important and I think needs to be discussed more is the fact, and I hate to say it like this, but, you know, if you don't want Walter to tell you, just don't ask it. The Republicans don't mind lying. They don't care what it is. If lying will give them what they want, and you take a Mitt Romney that has a history, he he has a history of having 2 or 3 sides to anything.
That's right.
Just whatever benefits him the most. Not you, not me, but him.
Well, that's true. Listen, the thing is that as Reverend Al Sharpton said, what does a liar do?
Willard.
He lies.
Yeah.
What does a liar do? He lies. And that's it.
Uh-huh.
And so we need, what else is in the cards for them to lie? And I want you to tell me, now, both of you are sitting there, I'm going to read another statement to you, and I want you to tell me who said it, okay? I am a liberator of companies. The point is, for lack of a better word, greed is right and it works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all of its forms, greed for life, greed for money, greed for love, knowledge, has marked the upsurge of mankind. The richest 1% of this country owns half of our country's wealth, $5 trillion. One-third of that comes from hard work. Two-thirds comes from inheritance, interest on interest accumulating to widows and idiot sons. And what do the other people do? They're in stock speculation. Now, who said that?
I don't know. I ain't going to lie to you.
Gordon Gekko.
Gordon who?
The film Wall Street, Gordon Gekko, Michael Douglas.
Well, the reason I didn't know is I never knew anybody off Wall Street that really mattered, so I just have to apologize.
Well, you do.
I should have read it somewhere.
Mr. Romney, the mister, this could fit his.
Well, you know, wait a minute, Mike. Nick Romney said that there are no poor people in America, you know.
Right.
How do you come up with a statement like that? All you have to do is look around. But when you have lived a prestigious life as he has, he's never known a day in which he did not know what he was going to eat. He's not known a day
where
he knows, how do I get gas in my car so I can get to work?
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't known any of those things, Mike. So he cannot connect with the real people.
No.
The president said the other day that, and all of us who went to college at one time had student loans. Now, the president says that he and his wife have been 8 years paying off their student loans, and they're just clear of them. So when you have people who have experienced those things,
yes,
they have a better understanding of what's going on in the real society out there. But when you have people that was sent to college, and every week I had a roommate at Greensburg College who was a part of the Apulian family, who had a lot of funeral parlors all throughout the country. Someone came to that room every Friday and picked up his laundry.
Right.
And here I am saying, wait a minute, how am I going to get my underwear cleaned this week? I got some underwear needs washed. And scrapping up my quarters and dimes to go to the little pay thing down in the basement of the dorm. But here's a guy who's never worried about that. And I had an experience with him. I had bought this new yellow shirt, and Bill had all the clothes in the world, someone to pick him up. And I was coming back to the dorm that evening, and he had my new yellow shirt on.
Oh,
I asked him to take it off. Take my shirt off. But, you know, he didn't think anything of that because he ran out of shirts. He just take one of mine. Well, I only had about 4 or 5, but he had a bundle. They were just in the laundry, and a car would come and bring his clothing back to him clean. You know, so a person who's lived that kind of life, Mike, cannot identify with this world out here where people don't have that kind of experiences in their life. People who have to really work to get whatever they're going to get, to raise their families, to protect their families, and try to send their kids to college. Now, I worked at St. Augustine's College for 23 years,
And there is a thing that you experience at an African-American college that you probably won't experience anywhere else. That there are people who come to college being the only person in that family that has ever gone to college. And the excitement of when that kid finally finishes that institution is like no other. The families are very proud. But there has been a lot of sacrificing going on, not only from the parents, but from people in the community, their churches, and anywhere else that they could get money from to help that child go to college.
Right.
So
right.
Privileged people don't have those experiences. So Romney, never had anything that way, Mike. He doesn't know anything about that. So he can make that statement about there are no poor people in America and think he's right. Because he doesn't know any better. As my grandmother would say, he is ignorant to the truth.
Well, I would like, do you have anything to add, Laska? I want to get over to our book signer here before he leaves, Mr. Walter Rogers.
Yes, sir.
Tell us what's more about the
Everybody that would, they need to read this book. I'm going to get me a copy tomorrow at the 8th District Black Leadership Caucus meeting in Hamlet at 10 o'clock. The young man has gone from inmate to mayor, and I think that it is a real inspiration. And the fact that he comes out of my congressional district just makes me that much more excited. Now, one other thing before we go back to the mayor in his book is, I think what Marsha said is very, very important. That which you have never been exposed to, you have no respect for. And I'll be real honest with you, it's very seldom that I go to bed at night trying to figure out how can Willard, I'll say like Reverend Thompson, how can Willard think that he can explain to 99% of the population anything when he's never had to live in their shoes?
Well, if that dog was still alive, we could ask his dog. But I don't think he's still alive, is he?
Well, I don't know if he's still alive or not, but I tell you what, I think that'll probably be the last dog that Willard will be ignorant enough to put on top of the car and tie him like a piece of luggage.
A piece of luggage, right. Well, I want to thank you, Walter Rogers, State Chair of the Black Leadership Caucus, and I will be seeing you next weekend and see you later today.
Okay. That works.
Right. And
promote the fact that you're going to be there and you're going to be presiding.
I'll be presiding, in front of his whip.
Huh?
I said, I'll be presiding, but in front of your whip.
Yes, sir. I'll be behind you, Marsha. Michael, with the wheel. Yes, sir, I still will.
Okay. I thank you.
Thanks
Walter
a lot.
Rogers. All right.
Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Michael?
Let's see. Yes. I want to get the mayor of Marshville on here if he could break away making his millions over here. I'm looking at a picture here that's really funny, and I got to show you this picture. It's a picture of Chris Christie at the Holy Wall in Israel, leaning against the wall with a yarmulke on, and he looks like a whale. It says Christie weighs in at Israel's holy site.
The whale at the wall.
If Captain Ahab only knew Moby Dick was, he's in Israel at the wall. There was one other thing before we were waiting for the mayor. There is an organization called. Have you heard about them, Marshall?
I didn't hear it, Mike.
There's an organization called ALEC.
ALEC.
ALEC. Yes.
Oh, I haven't heard of that. What they do?
Come on. The American Legislative Exchange Commission, or Council, I should say. American Legislative Exchange Council. And they, together with the Koch brothers, are the ones who have promoted the Stand Your Ground law, the Vote Against Amendment 1 law, the immigration laws. Here's the thing that most people don't understand. These elected officials, Republican elected officials, are so brain dead or can't even spell their own name. So what they got, this ALEC has said, don't worry about writing legislation. We're going to write the legislation for you. And that's what they have done. Over 60% of the legislation that the Progressive Party has passed since the president has been in office, and we did not know, but you know, see, they were a 501c3, and they were getting funding from Coca-Cola, AT&T, all the major corporations. Until recently, in the last 3 weeks or so, the major corporations, because ever since the Trayvon Martin, it happened because of Trayvon Martin, they have now been dropped by all these major companies. And they're going to be dropped, more of them are dropping off. And ALEC has now come to the position that they say they are no longer going to write any political bill.
You know, Michael, there's so many right-wing organizations in America. Nowhere else on earth they would have that freedom to create that kind of havoc in a country. Anywhere else they would be put out of business instantly. But here in America, we have right-wing organizations that grow out all, and it grows out of ignorance. And whatever I'm afraid of, then I try to destroy it. If I don't understand it, I want to destroy it. So a lot of these organizations come out of that kind of mode that they don't understand and they're afraid of it. Not having the intelligence to try to find out about it. They don't have courage to go out and find out about it. And, you know, you heard the old cliche, ignorance is bliss. It is bliss, very bliss. And ignorance is destroying our country.
Well, see, ALEC now, they've been working on this. This organization has been working together, I want to say secretly, but under the radar for over 40 years. And what they do is they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in an attempt to reshape the United States in a corporatocracy, where the country is no longer for the people, but is for the corporations. And to maximize the corporations' benefit for the corporations against social agendas or any social agendas.
But Mike, why do you think the president, the Congress is so adamant about not taxing the rich?
Absolutely.
Why are they so adamant about that? You answered that question just then.
Absolutely.
They're very adamant about not taxing people who can afford it. I applaud Warren Buffett when he said, you know, I've got more money than I'll ever use in my lifetime. My ancestors would never use all the money I have. Why not tax me at a rate? My housekeeper makes his tax more than I am. And you know, that's a shame. And he's probably not paying her a whole heck of a lot of money.
And wait a minute, he's got more than one housekeeper.
Right. All you see, and it's a shame. This guy was trillion. You know.
Well, the other thing about this is ALEC, their second thing that ALEC does is to actively promote the radical right-wing agenda for the Koch brothers, okay? And they consist of, they have one member of ALEC out of every three state legislatures in the country is a member of ALEC. I mean, so this is just completely incredible.
Right.
But right now, the mayor of Marshville here.
This is my fourth term, about 7 years now, going into my eighth year. Got elected first in 2005 and been mayor ever since.
And so tell us about this journey. I see you have a new book, and the name of the book is?
Oh, yeah. Well, the name of my book is From Inmate to Mayor. When I was a young man, I was a little hard-headed and wouldn't listen, and that didn't serve me well. I ended up going to prison with a 29-year sentence for armed robbery. Did about 10 and a half years in prison. Got out somewhere during that journey. I grew up and learned some sense, so I got out and changed my life around. So right here today, I am the only African-American in the United States to ever serve over 10 years in prison as a felon and then be elected mayor of the same city that I got in trouble in.
Now, as a mayor, what did you have to do to get your, since it was a felony, what did you have to do to get your voting privileges back?
Oh, and that's so simple here in North Carolina, and I'm glad you asked that question because people really need to know that.
Absolutely.
All you have to do is serve your time, get out, finish your parole. If you have any restitution, make your restitution. At that point, you just go to the Board of Elections and re-register. They will ask you to go to the clerk of court getting something showing that you're finished with your restitution or parole or everything and take that paper to them, and you're registered and you are a full citizen once again. It is that simple to get your voting rights back in North Carolina. One of the good things about North Carolina, several good things about North Carolina are going down the tubes. I'm sure that this Republican legislature that we got now, that's the next thing they'll probably attack. But,
I understand that Hillis and his gang were putting together a bill that would stop that.
I wouldn't doubt
that
one bit. I wouldn't doubt it one bit. What people have to understand is that minorities, lower income people, the lower social economic group is under attack. That we are under attack from the Tea Party right wing extremists. And if you don't realize that you're under attack, then you need to realize it because you can't fight. You can't fight a war if you don't know you're in battle.
Yeah, that's for sure. So tell us a little bit about the book. How long did you put it together?
Oh yeah, okay. The book. I first started working on my autobiography back in 2007, and I was writing my autobiography. But then these other thoughts were coming in my head, so I was writing them on a separate notebook. And I'm saying I'm coming back to that when I finish my autobiography. Well, after about a year and a half, you know, I had so much autobiography, but then I had about twice as much in this other notebook that I was writing now. So I realized I need to be writing this other book and come back to my autobiography later. So I started working on this other notebook that I had. It took me about 2.5 years, and that's what became the book that I have now. So basically, the book that I have now is sort of autobiographical, but it deals more with the lessons that I learned on this journey rather than just my autobiography.
Well, yeah, so the book is really not an autobiography from, you know, the time you can remember up until. It's the book is, where does it start?
Oh, it basically starts when I was in prison. It doesn't cover my youth and when I was a young man or in school and things like that. It basically talks about when I was in prison and the lessons that I learned and how I applied them in order to overcome the things that I was going through. So, again, it's sort of autobiographical, but it's not just the autobiography. It's a workbook. It's a book of hope, number one. It's a book that says to anybody, you can overcome whatever your circumstances are. Don't be defined by your circumstances, because your circumstances are not who you are. Those are just temporary situations that you find yourself in at one point or another. Don't let those control you. So it's a book that says you can overcome any of this. It's not going to be easy, but it can be done. It's a book of hope. Secondly, it's a book
that I've incorporated in it a workbook, because I want people to take the lessons that I learned and the principles that are in that book and apply them to their journey. You see, your journey is different from my journey, but the principles are the same. So if you take the principles of the book and the lessons that I learned, apply them to your journey, there are questions to be answered, there's exercises to be completed, and if you complete those exercises and answer those questions, by the time you finish my book, it is no longer my book. It is now your book about your journey. So that's basically, you know, what I wanted to accomplish with the book.
Well, I forgot where I was looking at this. It was, I guess it was in lockup. I really don't like watching it because the series, my daughter likes it. She watches it all the time. But because I just say, you know, it seems like everybody in prison can't be crazy. And all they show are the real nut jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, and realistically, how did you get by 10 and a half years?
Well, you know, Mike, to tell you the truth, I don't know. I won't say I was a nut job, but when I went, I was an angry, angry young man. I mean, I was fighting 2 and 3 times a week. I stayed in lock. People locked. They locked me up. I stay in lock up 7, 14, 15 days. Get out within 2 or 3 days. I was locked up again in another fight. Don't want to listen. I mean, you know, I even jumped on a guard one time, and you know that went all right for a minute. Till the rest of them got there. But you know, I was just an angry, angry young man. Mad at the world, mad at everybody, mad at the system, mad at the judge, the jury, their lawyer, my lawyer, mad at everybody until I realized the person I needed to be mad with was me, because I put me there. My actions put me there. And I realized, and when it finally, I could finally internalize this fact, that the choices and decisions that you make yesterday determine where you are today. And once you can internalize that fact, then you'll realize that the choices and decisions you make today will determine where you are tomorrow. So I always tell people, you can prepare. If you prepare today, you can own your tomorrow. So as far as these guys in prison, that they always pull out the quote-unquote nutcase, I think that's, you know, that's for ratings, that's for TV, that's what people want to see. Advertisers want to pay for. But there are some guys in prison who don't want to be in prison, who want to change. They just need an opportunity.
When did you decide, when you were in prison, that, you know, I've got to change? What was the turning factor?
Well, Mike, I tell you, it's hard to say. I was actually on an interview yesterday, and that question in a different form came up. And as I said in that interview, you know, it's so hard to just come up with a time, because it was more like subtle changes overlapping. I mean, for instance, when I jumped on that guard that time, that led me to realize I needed to take responsibility for myself. And I started, my mindset started to change then, meaning I started to look at things a little differently. Now, all of a sudden, I wasn't just an ideal inmate. I still got in little things, but I wasn't doing things the same way I had been. And then over the course of time, as I worked my way out of Central Prison, out into medium custody and to another camp, you know, at one point I realized that I was as close to death as I could be in prison and still be alive. And see, those kind of things instilled in me a determination that I wouldn't be defined by this death, that I would do what I needed to do to redefine myself, to resurrect myself. So all these little subtle changes led to me finally being released with a totally different mindset. And what I did, I didn't come out of prison with the idea, I'm going to be the mayor of Marshall, or I'm going to start a business and be an entrepreneur. I came out of prison with one thought, I am not going back there. And it was a determination to do whatever I needed to do to make sure that didn't happen. And then as I did that and just carried myself in such a way to respect other people and to gain other people's respect and their trust, these other things just came as I was doing that.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people that say, yeah, I'm not going back to prison no more. And they go out, and now, instead of just robbery, they're going out for murder because they want to kill before they go back to prison. So they have not learned or went down the same road as you did.
But it's about mindset, Mike, in my opinion. I really feel like, you know, a lot of times guys come out and they have that in their mind, they say, I'm not going back to prison. But they hadn't made up their mind that they're going to do whatever it takes not to go back. What I mean by that is, you know, it wasn't easy. I worked a job. They worked me. Oh, man, they worked me like a runaway slave, if I can say that on the radio, I don't know. But, I mean, they worked me that hard. And I wanted to say several times, look, I'm not putting up with this anymore. I don't have to put up with this. But I didn't have another job, so I put up with it until I could do better. And that's what I say. You got to have the mindset that I'm just not going back there. And I'm going to do what I need to do to stay out. So that's why I feel like a lot of times we need to get to the guys while they're still in and start working on their mindset, start teaching them, you know, to think differently. And then when they do get out, there's a lot of good programs out here, that reentry programs that can help them, but you got to have the right mindset before it works.
Well, you know, because I want Marshall to ask you something here, but I just wanted to, you mentioned something that's so important to me, and that is, how do you determine the mindset? Because prison is not built for rehabilitation. It's for incarceration.
I agree.
So how do we get people that can't come to that same conclusion like you did? How do we turn them around? You can't do it in prison.
You know, to tell you the truth, Michael, and I'm going to make this statement, and I hope it doesn't sound too far out of left field. You can't turn anybody around anyway, in prison or out of prison.
Unless they want to do it.
They got to turn themselves around, and then you got to support them and help them.
Right.
But they've got to turn themselves around. They've got to change their mindset. You can put it there in front of them or with and show it to them and talk to them, but inside themselves, they got to say, you know what, I can get with that. I'm going to change this. But, you know, I don't feel like you can. I don't feel like you can change or anybody. I just don't believe it.
Marshall, you have something you want to ask the mayor?
I think the mayor did an adequate job of explaining and telling how he dealt with his life, and I think that's a plus. But we have so many of our brothers and sisters who, once they are incarcerated, they think the world has just ended and make no effort to make correct a wrong, and they continue. Well, my first job I had was with the Department of Correction, and I was a parole officer, and my whole thing was to try to get my fellows, and they just started allowing men to work with females also at that point. I was to get them to see that there was a better way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started a program called Pre-Release and Aftercare. We would take people out of the prison system and for 4 weeks expose them to other things other than what they had been exposed to prior to going there. We did educational things, we did tours, we did lectures, and we did dress-up things. At the end of the 4 weeks, we always had a graduation ceremony, and we encouraged them to invite persons in their family to that graduation, because what the philosophy was, that if the family was involved, the family could become committed to help this person to correct and to improve his life, then that person would cut down on the recidivism in the system. And
right.
It worked. I think we cut it by 48% at that time. But again, politics got into it. It was under the Model Cities Program for ex-offenders.
And under that program, 50 Dick decided that time had come because of the industry. We talked about that earlier, how prison was an industry.
Right.
How the industry of locking people up was losing its grip. And they were funded. Now, Jim Hunt at that time was lieutenant governor. And we had Jim Hunt to introduce a bill in the state legislature that funded 60% of the program. And we went back to the feds, and they did 40. And it lasted for about six more years. But they gradually phased it out. As Republicans took over the legislature, hold however, and then Jim Martin's program ended.
We got about another minute. About 30 seconds.
I'm finished. But anyway, those programs, things like that, to help people to get back on track with their lives.
All right, Mayor, tell us the name of the book again.
The website is www.FromInmateToMayor.com, and that's the name of the book and the name of the website, and certainly I'd appreciate any support that anyone gives us.
Okay, www.FromInmateToMayor.com.
That's correct.
By Frank Dees, Mayor of Marshville. I want to thank everybody for being listening, and I want to thank the mayor and thank everybody else, Walter Rogers and Colonel Robinson and Mr. Yates, Mayor Yates, and Bradford Thompson, and our musical accompaniment by Mr. Marshall Harvey. And I want to thank everybody for listening. This has been The Last Word, and we're going to have a good time tonight at the Black Summit in Raleigh, North Carolina, U.S. of A. Good night.
On July 1st of this year, the interest rates on Stafford student loans, the same loans that many of you used to help pay for college, are set to double. And that means some hardworking students will be paying about $1,000 extra just to get their education. So I've called on Congress to prevent this from happening. What we said is simple. Now is not the time to make school more expensive for our young people.
Oh, yeah. You should listen to the president. Or as I like to call him, the Prezi of the United Steezy. Things are heating up inside Congress's chambers behind all those closed doors. So the president made a few discreet calls across the aisle. He said, hey, let's get together on this one. Without an affordable Stafford loan, where can a student turn? The Pell Grant is a beautiful thing, but with college getting more expensive, is it enough by itself to satisfy all your collegiate needs? Oh, Pell no. Oh, Pell no. If Congress doesn't act, it's the students who play. So write an extra joint on this like Kim and Kanye.
Now, there's some in Congress who disagree. They say keeping the interest rate low isn't the way to help our students. They say we should be doing everything we can to pay down the national debt. Well, so long as it doesn't include taxing billionaires. But their position is that students just have to make this rate increase work. Frankly, I don't buy it.
The Barackness monster ain't buying it. We all know our legislative body is in the House tossing and turning late into the night. But still, Republicans disagree and could even filibuster. But if they do, the president says they're gonna feel it, but
the GOP is steady saying no, no, no. They should find something new to do like Tim Tebow.
The reason it's so important to keep down costs is so we keep college affordable.
And the president knows his stuff, y'all. That's why they call him the POTUS, which means person on top. What is it?
Jimmy, POTUS stands for President of the United States.
He's the POTUS with the most.
Let's keep the rates down on college loans.
Stop the loan you say may be old. Yeah. Let's get it together and make our lives better. Cause the college degree is more than a few letters. If college don't rise, go ahead.
slow jam the news.
Oh, yeah.
Give it up for President Barack Obama.
Oh, my God, Mike. Come on, Mr. President, we got back. Come on back.